Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In case you haven't seen it, there was a devastating three-part series in the New York Times this week about New Jersey's system of halfway houses for low-level criminal convicts. There have been more than 5,000 escapes since 2005, 1,300 of them since Governor Christie took office, according to the series. Violence is so bad at some facilities that inmates regularly ask to return to prison where they feel safer, according to the articles. And this is a privatized system, part of the prison industrial complex, you might say, with the company that runs the halfway houses very well connected to Governor Christie and other New Jersey pals. We'll talk now to Sam Dolnick, who reported this series for The Times, and later to a company official who wants to come on to respond. Sam Dolnick, welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
So let's start here. You wrote about the facility called Delaney Hall in Essex County that is supposed to be for low-level criminals, but increasingly violent ones are being housed there with violent results. Explain what the guidelines are supposed to be and how they're actually being used.
Delaney Hall opened in 2000, right next door to the Essex County Jail. The Essex County Jail opened a few years later. Delaney Hall opened in 2000, as I say. And it was meant to house people who had been sentenced for minor crimes, less than a year in jail. It quickly changed and began housing people who had not yet been sentenced but had a bail limit of $50,000. And over the years, that bail limit has grown. So now it's at $100,000. So anyone who is being held on $100,000 bail or less, or some people who have been sentenced to minor crimes, would be housed in Delaney Hall instead of the county jail.
With violent results?
Often, yeah. We reported yesterday on a murder that happened inside Delaney Hall in 2009. A man had been held for unpaid traffic tickets inside Delaney Hall. He was mixed with violent criminals, people who were being held on violent charges, people with histories of violent arrests. And he was murdered in his cell during a robbery, killed for $3.
What is a halfway house in New Jersey today? Give our listeners some background here. What kinds of facilities are these in general, and what are they supposed to be for?
Well, a halfway house, the idea, I think, conjures up still a house on the edge of town where a dozen men straighten up and dry out. The industry has evolved in recent decades so that now these halfway houses are as large as prisons themselves, hundreds of beds, up to 1,000 beds. And they are meant to house inmates finishing up their sentences, sometimes parolees, and they're supposed to offer treatment, substance abuse treatment, anger management, classes that help inmates make the transition back into society.
What happened to the small group home, the model that people are familiar with? Was it deemed ineffective or too expensive, or why has it been replaced by these massive institutions?
Well, I should say there are some of them left. The New Jersey's halfway house system encompasses about two dozen or so different facilities, and some of them are quite small, more traditional. But I think it's the same business model that you see in other industries, which is the economy of scale. So if you can build a giant facility and fill it with hundreds and hundreds of inmates, it's a lot easier to make money than if you're doing it on a small scale with only a dozen men.
I think one of the things that really jumped out at people and caught everybody's attention in the first article of the series on Sunday was those shocking escape numbers, which, as you must know, the company disputes. So where does the number 5,100 escapes in 7 years come from, and what constitutes an escape from something that isn't really a prison?
It's a good question. Those numbers are all from the state's data. A number of open records requests and got the names and circumstances of every person who has fled the custody of a halfway house. And that can happen in a bunch of different ways. You can leave through the back door, the side door, climbing over the fence. We've got lots and lots of those instances documented. But it also can be you're out on work release. When you're in a halfway house, you are often given privileges where you're out in the community. And then when you don't return, that is an escape. You are under the legal custody of the halfway house. And if you don't return, you can be then prosecuted for crime of escape.
So let me play you a clip of Vice President for Business Development of the company, William Palatucci, who we'll also talk about as being someone who's very close to Governor Christie, and we'll talk about where that comes in.
Yep.
But he did an interview with NJ Today this week. You'll hear him characterize your motivations in doing the series in a certain way, and then he'll get specific about why he disagrees with this number of escapees or escapes. Take a listen.
They're just sensationalizing a field that they don't agree with and that they don't like. And they frankly ran their editorial on the front page of their paper without calling it an editorial. They're using the word, the alarming statistic, that over the seven-year period that they studied, that there were 5,100 escapes. You know, I think for the average person, when you or I might hear the word escape, we're thinking of the Shawshank Redemption movie with Tim Robbins, where he, you know, digs his way out of prison. That's not what happens in New Jersey. There have not been 5,100 escapes. The New York Times knowingly knew that there's a distinction between particularly people who are on parole, and most of those 5,100 people are people who have been paroled. They're out in the community, and they have violated some terms of their parole.
So, Sam, specifically on the end part of that, the New York Times knowingly knew there is a distinction between particularly people on parole, and most of those 5,100 people had been paroled. They're out in the community, and they violated some terms of their parole. How much do you disagree with his characterization of that in terms of understanding how much of an escape problem they have?
Well, it's a technical argument. About that 5,100 number is about half inmates who are Department of Corrections inmates still, and about half parolees. They were paroled to halfway houses. The terms of their parole are they must be under the supervision of the halfway house. If they flee, then they can be charged with a crime. 3 to 5 years is the penalty. He's making a distinction. I think he said the word abscond. The effect is the same. It's someone who has the state has ordered to the custody of a halfway house, and then they're out in the public.
We can take phone calls, listeners, if anybody has personal experience as an inmate, as a relative of someone who was there, as an employee or former employee of these halfway houses in New Jersey run by the company called Community Education Centers, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. After the three-part New York Times expose this week, we're talking to the reporter of that series, Sam Dolnick, and later we'll have a company official on, 212-433-WNYC, if you have anything to add or ask, or post it to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. You report on violent and drug-ridden conditions. 70% of inmates at one facility called Bo Robinson in Trenton testing positive for drugs, and an atmosphere so violent there that inmates regularly ask to be returned to prison, according to employees you quote. How big a problem is this?
It's a pretty serious problem. We spoke with dozens and dozens of employees and inmates. And I should say that since the series have come out, we've been flooded with new information about the system and its regulation. So drugs are prevalent. We've heard that from staffers and inmates and law enforcement officials. It's easy to obtain drugs inside. And the corrections department acknowledges this. You know, the halfway houses, by definition, have looser restrictions than prisons. So contraband can flow in easier.
And your series describes the financial incentives to house more and more inmates in the halfway houses rather than in the prisons. The county pays for halfway house beds. Then it charges in rent, basically, for the county's own prison beds and comes out in the black. How does that work?
Yeah. The Essex County Jail is a giant facility built relatively recently. And it's become a source of great revenue for Essex County. They rent beds, about 40% of the facility is now rented to federal authorities to house federal inmates and immigrant detainees. The feds pay a lot of money for that. So what the county does is it sends its inmates to Delaney Hall, which is this private facility we were talking about, where for about $70 a day, they charge, the company pays them, charges them, and then they bill the feds about $108, $110 a day to house detainees. So that the difference there is profit that has added up to tens of millions of dollars in revenue for the county.
So the implication is that they're moving people from prison to the halfway houses who perhaps are not nonviolent enough or ready to be moved into these partly in the community facilities, lower security facilities, for the sake of money. Do you draw that conclusion?
Well, there's a distinction to be drawn. The Essex County arrangement we're talking about, that's a county jail. That's not a state prison.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not people who have been sentenced there to long term.
Okay.
That's people who have been arrested recently and are awaiting arraignment, awaiting trial, waiting on bail. And it's people being held on minor charges. So they say that they only send the low-level offenders to Delaney Hall, and they keep the serious criminals, the people charged with violent crimes, in Essex County. Our report, we obtained internal documents from the county jail that show that's not the case, that show violent inmates are, in fact, being housed by the dozens in Delaney Hall.
Let's take a phone call. Jamil in Piscataway. You're on WNYC. Hello, Jamil.
Hello, good morning. I just wanted to offer the consideration that part of the challenge, I think, with some of these statistics being reported is the nature of the information. A person that is classified as an escapee, for example, may have terms that say they need to be back on the premises if they're given free time. They might need to be back on the premises at 8 p.m. Well, if that person comes back at 8:10 p.m., they could be reported as an escapee, and those statistics don't bear out whether or not that person actually returns. So somebody that comes back at 8:30 p.m. because they miss a cab or because they got mixed up with a bad crowd trying to readjust gets reported as leaving, even if they end up back on the premises and subject to disciplinary action.
Jamil, thank you very much. Acknowledge, Sam, and so maybe the 5,100 looks like more than it is?
It's an important point. The Department of Corrections makes that point as well. So when they gave us the data, they weeded out what they called the technical violators, who are people who were trying to get back in all good faith and were late, but had no intention to abscond. So when they gave us the number that adds up to roughly 5,100, they say they weeded out all of those kinds of people who were merely late.
The company's homepage on their website has the phrase breaking the cycle of recidivism. And I want to take a step back because the idea of halfway houses for nonviolent offenders is supposed to be a progressive one. It's easy for us to get, upset about the prison industrial complex and privatization to a for-profit company trying to serve a public purpose. But there is a progressive idea here, which is fewer young people needlessly getting hardened in real prisons when they could be getting treatment and rehabilitation. So did you investigate if the company actually provides the treatment and rehabilitation that it's supposed to and whether the halfway house system is working on that level, which may be the most profound level? The company says it is.
Yes, and it's an important point. The as you say, the system was created with progressive intentions. They wanted to help people. They wanted to help inmates, a population that often doesn't get a lot of help. And let me just be clear, this company, Community Education, they are the major player in the industry, but they are by no means the only operator of halfway houses. There are lots of other nonprofits who are operating halfway houses in New Jersey. But are they offering any treatment? Yes, sure. There are counselors in there. There are some dedicated ones who are working their hardest and really believe in the mission. But what we found is that the wages are so low, the places are so thinly staffed that it's really hard to deliver effective services to such a difficult population at such a large scale.
They say on their site that they have an 11% reduction in the recidivism rate in their populations which is the best in the Northeast and one of the best in the country. Do you dispute it, or did you not look into that aspect of it?
No, we certainly looked into that aspect of it. That 11.4 number is New Jersey's recidivism rate, the state, not halfway houses at all.
Uh-huh.
The state says that halfway houses have played a role in that, though the commissioner of corrections certainly didn't say that it was even a major role. But the state has never looked at the halfway houses, their specific recidivism. You know, about 10,000 people cycle through these every year, and the state has never studied, despite spending hundreds of millions of dollars on it, what kind of results these halfway houses are delivering. Last year, the administration said they commissioned a study to study exactly that, the halfway houses recidivism rate, but they said it would take 3 to 4 years to complete.
We are talking, listeners, about the New York Times series this week about halfway houses for low-level offenders in New Jersey, drugs, violence, lack of rehab, and many escapes from these privatized facilities run by a politically connected company, according to the series. When we come back after a break, we'll finish up with the Times correspondent on this, Sam Dolnick, on the connections to Governor Christie and other politicians, and then we'll get a response from a company official. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC. We're talking about the New York Times series this week about halfway houses for low-level offenders in New Jersey, drugs, violence, lack of rehab, and many escapes from these privatized facilities run by a politically connected company. According to the series, we'll get a company response in just a minute. We're talking to the New York Times correspondent who investigated this, Sam Dolnick. And Sam, on the politics, you make a point of describing a top executive of the company as very close with Governor Christie. His name is William Palatucci. We played a clip of him earlier. But you also point out that these problems you catalog predate Christie being governor and that the rate of escapes has declined during Christie's tenure. What's your conclusion about Governor Christie's relationship to these problems?
Governor Christie certainly didn't set up this system. That should be made clear. He is, however, very close to the company that dominates the system. He was registered as a lobbyist for community education before he became U.S. Attorney General. And as U.S. Attorney General, he visited these facilities. He continued visiting them as governor. He has
You're saying Christie himself was registered as a lobbyist for this company?
That's right, yeah.
Okay. Fascinating.
Yeah. Christie's office says that he did no work for the company. He and Mr. Palatucci were registered together, and they say Mr. Palatucci handled the lobbying. But yes, according to disclosure reports, he was registered as a lobbyist. He has, since he's become governor, held up community education as an example of how he believes the correction system should be run.
The governor has already responded to your series by ordering stepped-up inspections of the halfway houses. Do you have reason to believe the governor's office was surprised by what you found and is taking it seriously?
It sounds like they are. We'll see what results come of it. We disclosed everything we had found to the corrections department before we published the series, and so they were aware of what we were reporting. And yeah, I think it is certainly fair to say that they were surprised by a lot of it.
And NorthJersey.com has a column by Charles Stile today critical of Christie because supposedly he's a reformer, but his relationship with this company, despite its problems, shows he's more business as usual than he claims, according to the columnist. But he also accuses state Democrats of being silent in response to your series because the company is well-connected on both sides of the aisle. Would you agree with him about that?
Well, I'm not going to get into the political implications of it. You know, it's still early days. The final story just published yesterday. The assemblyman who chairs the Law and Public Safety Committee is a Democrat. He called for hearings into the matter. So I don't think it's quite right to say that they've been silent, but we'll be very interested to see what the reaction is in the coming days and weeks.
Before we bring on the company official, what kinds of reforms do you think, or do your sources think, need to be undertaken here to make the system actually safe for the people who are housed there, actually secure, so that there aren't whatever number of thousands of escapes, and actually effective in terms of rehab and treatment that they're supposed to provide?
Well, I don't think I'm at all qualified to offer policy recommendations, but I can say that the people that we've spoken to are, many of them are minimum wage, just above minimum wage, $11 an hour. They are they get about a week of training, maybe a day or two of that dedicated to security, and they can be then placed on the overnight shift responsible for 170 inmates who are again held in rooms without bars, without locks. They're alone, without weapons, these workers responsible for that. That is the workers we've spoken to said that it felt unsafe. So, and we've seen that the regulation of these places has been lax. So I think regulation, as the governor has said, will be increased.
New York Times correspondent Sam Dolnick, thank you very much for discussing your series with us.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
And if you're just joining us, folks, we're talking about the New York Times series this week about halfway houses for low-level offenders in New Jersey, drugs, violence, lack of rehab, and many escapes from these privatized facilities run by a politically connected company, according to the series. But the company was very eager to respond and contacted us about appearing today, in addition to the Times reporters. So joining us now is Dr. Robert Mackey, Senior Vice President of Clinical Services and Research at the company known as Community Education Centers. Dr. Mackey, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate the opportunity to come on.
Give us your most earnest, balanced response to this article. Do you just want to say the Times doesn't get you, or do you want to say, okay, we have real problems here, but not as bad as they say?
I think the issue here is staying with the facts. I think that that Mr. Dolnick, what he reported on was not factual. So I think the important thing here is just to take it away from the company, if you will, take it away from the Times and really look at what are the facts that underlie or really override this entire issue. We're working in a system right here in New Jersey that I think is probably the best in the country, and the facts support that. The sentencing project talks about a 24% reduction in the prison population in the last 10 years. Much of that has been attributed to the halfway house or community reentry system. The notion, again, and I think you discussed it earlier, the fact that these are halfway houses is misleading. I think in New Jersey, they're called community release centers. It is a more innovative, more diverse, more complex solution to the problem. So I think we need to look at, you know, what is it that we're actually talking about that I think that Mr. Dolnick didn't address adequately, and you know, what are the true facts surrounding this? You know, he mentioned the distinction between escapes and absconds to be a meaningless distinction. The fact of the matter is that fewer than half of the people of the 5,000 that he mentioned are, in fact, escapes. I heard you briefly talk about, you know, that what constitutes an escape. An escape from a halfway house can be failure to return. I don't believe that the department made a distinction about weeding out who was an escape, who was not. When we report the escapes from the DOC, the Department of Corrections population, all of those numbers are in that population. The abscond number, which is more than 50%, are those individuals that have been classified as appropriate by the parole board for community placement. They've been in the community. They've technically violated a condition of their parole. They're returned to a halfway back program, a community release program such as the ones that we run and other vendors. And some of those individuals out on work release, approved work release, fail to return back to the facility. That's an abscond. Although they're both punishable by the same sentencing process, the fact of the matter is that very few fewer than 2% of the people that actually could be charged with escape are in fact charged with escape.
Let me go on to another thing from the series about your Bo Robinson facility in Trenton.
Right.
The Times says this 900-bed facility often seems to embody the worst in the prisons it was intended to supplant. Imagine a sizable penitentiary filled with inmates, some with violent records, but lacking the supervision that prevents such places from falling into bedlam. It says inmates regularly ask to be returned to prison where they feel safer, according to workers at Bo Robinson. And maybe you heard Sam Dolnick say that they've interviewed many, 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 many inmates, former inmates, workers, former inmates. It sounds ugly.
I'm actually calling you from Bo Robinson. This is not an unsafe environment. To begin with, I think Sam doesn't also understand the nature of Bo Robinson. We have a number of people, contracts at this facility. Some of the individuals here are county, referred by the county. Some are referred by the parole department. Some are referred by the Department of Corrections. Those individuals referred by the Department of Corrections have achieved, through the classification system in the department, full minimum custody status. These are people that are within probably a year and a half of being released from supervision by the Department of Corrections. So, I think that Mr. Dolnick has his facts wrong. The staff here have reported to me. I walk around the building. I speak to staff myself. They're also union. There's union oversight at this facility. If the union leaders here felt that their staff were in any way in jeopardy or undertrained or under not being provided with the level of security and safety, they would indicate that.
Well, the article certainly quotes workers who make those assertions, and it describes one or two low-wage workers supervising 170 inmates in a barrack-style facility. Is that adequate?
Actually, the number that particular number I gave to Sam, that was at our Kearney facility, where in fact on a third shift we might have two staff members specifically assigned to that particular unit of 150 to 170 people. If you look at the records over the last 14 years in that particular facility, not a single staff member has been assaulted or threatened on that unit. It's not the nature, it's not the culture of these facilities to have that level of threat levied. Does it ever happen? Absolutely.
Then why does he find people who say that they felt safer or that inmates felt safer going back to prison and that those requests come regularly?
Well, number one, they don't come regularly, and secondly, I think he's making a leap here. Inmates at these facilities do request to go back to prison because the therapeutic requirements at these facilities is much more difficult to sustain than basically laying up in a prison cell. So there are a number of people that come through the program. They're recommended by the Department of Corrections. They come in here. They realize that they're going to have to get up in the morning, go through a very structured day where there's a great deal of accountability. And for many of them that are completely unmotivated to make the changes necessary in their life, they do, in fact, request to go back to prison. To say that they go back to prison because they feel safer in prison is ludicrous.
Listeners, a few of you who are hanging on, I apologize. We were just about to get to you. If Tracy, who is hanging on, wants to call back, if Jim in Plainfield, who is hanging on, wants to call back, we'll go right to you, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, as we talk to Robert Mackey, Senior Vice President of Clinical Services and Research at the halfway house company called Community Education Centers, written up in the New York Times investigative series this week, 212-433-9692. We will take a call now from Arthur in Newark. Arthur, thank you for calling.
Thank you. How you doing?
All right. What's up?
Well, first of all, let me thank you for answering my call. Now, we heard about the series. I read some of the articles, and speaking from a personal experience at one of the CEC facilities back in 1998, my feelings are kind of hurt. And I say that because there's thousands and thousands of alumni, and I just happen to be the director of that particular program for CEC, that thousands of people have come through these programs, and their lives have changed. Their lives have changed. They've given back communities. Their fathers, you've given parents back their sons. And, you know, unfortunately, through disgruntled or bad choices, some things have happened. The same things that happen in secure facilities, which are called prisons. But overall, I believe the effectiveness of these programs has made a dramatic impact on how we treat crime in the state of New Jersey.
So that
you
was
can
back
keep locking
your...
these people up, but eventually, if they don't get life sentences, they're going to come home. So for me, coming through the program was was probably the safest and the best thing that has ever happened to me.
That's a great testimonial. Did the company ask you to call, by the way?
No. They didn't ask me to call. I called because this is a passion of mine. Whether or not I worked for the company, not even before I started working for the company, I was always involved in our alumni association.
What do you think, though? So you went through in 98. What do you think when you read in the Times that in recent years, as they portray it, on the mission of rehab and job training, which it sounds like was so important to your life, that now they have former employees saying they have neither the time nor the skills to do it under the system
as it's being run.
I would question
those employees' motives. Now, I don't know if these employees still currently work for us or whether someone terminated based on something they did. And now this is a rebuttal back to that.
So it could be a disgruntled employee. Arthur, thank you very much. I really appreciate you're chiming in with your own experience. It sounds like it was very meaningful for you. And Tracy in Far Hills, back on the phone with us. Tracy, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for having me. I just wanted to just give a little experience that I've had as the sister of someone who's serving prison time for being a drug user. My brother was a heroin addict, and he got on the drug court program in New Jersey, and he went to a rehab/halfway house in Secaucus, and his roommate was dealing drugs in the room. He relapsed there once and left and came home because he was nervous, you know, just being in an environment with negative people and having drugs around and the violence. And they sent him right back there, and the same thing happened. So he came home again, and he got violated for probation. And he's now serving 4 years in prison voluntarily because he doesn't want to. He's too scared to go back to a halfway house or a rehab. He'd rather be in the prison system.
So there's an example of exactly what we were talking about before. Tracy, thank you very much. So Robert Mackey, you heard Tracy's story. I don't expect you to necessarily respond to that in particular.
I think it is important to respond, Brian, because the system that Tracy's talking about is not the system that the article was about or that we operate in.
That was not one of your facilities that she was referring to.
It's not even in the network of facilities. And I'm sorry to hear about her brother or family member, but drug court programs are programs that are diversion programs from prison, and the rehab and the halfway house system she's talking about is a system completely unrelated to the system that you and I are discussing
here. But the article did cite tests by, I think, the state of inmates at one of your facilities, and they found that over 70% of the people there tested positive for drugs. So what does that say about the security?
Well, I think we're talking about one instance. This was a county population coming in from Mercer County. This is not the Department of Corrections population we're talking about. It's not the parole population we're talking about. It's a county population that comes into the facility basically from the street, processed very quickly, comes in from the street. And I'm sure you're aware of the fact that if you use drugs, especially marijuana, even days, weeks prior to entry into a correctional facility or one of our facilities, those people will test positive for up to 28 days. So many of those people that tested positive within the first 10 days of their entry.
So you're saying they weren't in your charge long enough to have negative drug tests. We're running out of time. I want to get one other thought from you on the Essex County situation, where the articles reported that the county makes money by moving inmates who maybe aren't ready to be moved in some cases to the halfway houses because they pay you less than they make from the federal government for housing federal inmates and detainees there. Do you at the company feel like the county has been pressuring you to take inmates who you really don't want in these halfway houses?
No, we work cooperatively with the county. I don't believe that there's been any pressure. What the county does through their classification process is they first determine whether or not people can be deemed eligible for a facility like Delaney Hall based on limits like bail. Bail is one of the criteria that would be based on. They also take other things into consideration as well. You know, whether or not this person would benefit from the level of treatment services that exist at Delaney Hall that don't exist at the Essex County Jail. So I think that determination isn't singly faceted in the sense that, you know, people are driven at the classification or referral level based on money. Nobody at the level of making those determinations in any way benefits economically from the determination of who goes to Delaney Hall or who is retained back at Essex County Jail.
Last thing in our last minute. Why should the public believe you, with the company's obvious self-interest here, over the Times, which is an independent news organization?
Well, I think what the public should believe are the facts. I think the facts are emanating from the Sentencing Project, which is independent, it's national, from the Pew Report, which has a national and international reputation, from the independent university research that's conducted on our facilities, from the national accrediting organizations like the American Corrections Association, that every 3 years comes in and does an extensive review of all of our policies, practices, speaks to staff on all three shifts, and then subsequently writes reports that would indicate whether or not this is a program that's meeting the standards that have been established at the national level. All of our facilities in New Jersey and across the country have met those standards, not only at 100% on mandatory standards, but all of the non-mandatory standards. So, again, these are professionals coming in with far more experience than someone from the Times that are national experts that are indicating that the services in New Jersey are excellent services. So, yeah, please don't believe me. You know, believe the external accrediting and review sources that have found this system to be the best, one of the best in the nation.
Dr. Robert Mackey, Senior Vice President of Clinical Services and Research at Community Education Centers, responding to the New York Times series on problems at the halfway house system in New Jersey that they run. We heard earlier from the New York Times investigative reporter on the series, Sam Dolnick. Dr. Mackey, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come. Stay tuned.